Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's Brian Lehrer, and this is my Daily Politics Podcast from WNYC Studios. It's Monday, June 8th. On day 100 since the first confirmed case of COVID-19 in New York City, day 12 since the first protest over the death of George Floyd in town. And on this day 100, the city enters phase one of reopening. And on this day 12, Mayor de Blasio will see a protest out his office window and his home office window as members of his own administration, unhappy with how he's handled protesters and the police, will be marching from City Hall to Gracie Mansion. Yesterday, however, he did change his tune about cutting police funding as part of the coronavirus budget deficit. Now the NYPD will take some cuts, he says, along with all the other agencies. The city of Minneapolis, where George Floyd was killed, of course, plans to dismantle and reconstruct its police department now. The New York State Legislature will take up repeal of the so-called 50A law today. That's the law that shields police disciplinary records from public view. Congress will take up police reform today, too. According to the New York Times, the legislation would make it easier to prosecute police misconduct and recover damages. It would also create a national registry to track police misconduct and ban certain chokeholds and other tactics, according to a draft provided to the New York Times. With us now, L. Joy Williams, president of the Brooklyn chapter of the NAACP. She is also a political strategist who has worked on the campaigns of candidates including Jumaane Williams, Letitia James, and Cynthia Nixon. She's been a Wisconsin Get Out the Vote supervisor for the John Kerry for President campaign in 2004. Getting out the vote in Wisconsin will certainly be a really important job for someone this year. And she's host of the podcast Sunday Civics. Joy, thanks so much for coming on today. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you so much for having me, Brian.
So first of all, how much do you think the protest movement is poised to accomplish important things? And how would you define success?
Well, I do think that the protests and the atmosphere that exists right now has created the stage for and created the opportunity for those of us activists and advocates who have been pushing this legislation for some time. It creates the atmosphere for them to be considered and for them to be passed. Let's think back, just as you said at the top, in terms of where we are in the middle of a pandemic, all across the country, but particularly being hit hard here in New York, New York State. And we had a state legislature that, although they had passed rules to allow them to continue a legislative session remotely, you know, by all points, you know, the plan was to address emergency issues that were related to coronavirus, and then the legislative session would end. And up until the protests and highlighting these issues, even Governor Cuomo himself was signaling that it was the end of session, like there was nothing else to do besides respond to the issues of the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And while certainly the pandemic and our response on the local level all across the state as well as the state level is certainly something that we had to address and continue need to address because there's disparities in that, these bills were left on the table, some of them, particularly the 50A legislation that you mentioned. So this didn't come out of just taking 50A for an example, mm-hmm. and there are more bills to be considered that, but they didn't come out of thin air in the past 12 days. You know, these were part of legislative agendas for NAACP, for Change the NYPD, Citizens United for Police Reform, all of the organizations. These have existed for this time. What the protest and what highlighting this issue has done is allowed the opportunity for the legislature to go back into session to address these issues immediately. And then as you see a shift from the governor of also saying, yes, he'll, you know, sign it and participate in this.
Mayor de Blasio now says he will cut the NYPD budget along with most other budgets, to close the budget deficit that the city is facing so that other programs, like for vulnerable youth and other things, can be spared a little more. The police department was going to be held pretty much exempt in the corona-caused budget crisis. Do you find the move meaningful, and why do you think it took them this long?
Well, I can't answer the question in terms of why it took him so long. I mean, again, this is a mayor that, as a candidate, campaigned on these issues, and particularly and knows very well from the advocates and the activists, having been on the other side of a protest himself, that the need and investment in our communities to make sure that we have resource communities, particularly for young people, particularly for those who are at the first sign of any cuts that need to be made, that they are on their issues, their resources, and their needs are on the chopping block. So again, I think the collaborative of the city raising their voices, that we want to invest in the resources of our people, of our young people, of those who are homeless, of our students in schools, rather than continuing to or hold exempt cuts from institutions like policing, which further can cause harm in, without accountability. And so, you know, I think that at this point, just like the governor has and, you know, other elected leaders and other, you know, corporate and other leaders have recognized that this moment is not going away and that it's an opportunity for you to step up and take leadership here. And so we're, you know, ecstatic that the mayor is reversing course on that. And I look forward to see specifically how he plans to address that in dollars and cents.
Let's go on to Alec in Manhattan. Alec, you're on WNYC. Hello.
Hi, how you doing, Brian? Good morning. How you doing?
Good morning. How you doing?
Good. I just called in to give my opinion, you know, as an officer of over 20 years working for this department, minority officer. Mm-hmm. You know, I'll tell you that we ourselves and many of us, you know, are kind of like reluctant to speak up because of the consequences that can come our way, you know. We ourselves, you know, get treated in the department as second-class citizens, you know, and we feel like we don't have a voice. And when we do try to speak up, you know, consequences come our way. And as far as, you know, changing the department, this is something that should have taken place, you know, 10, 15 years ago. You know, why wait until something, you know, like this implodes and to start seeking answers? They knew, you know, the department knew that changes needed to be, you know, brought into place. And they're just very slow to act. You know, the problem is the hierarchy of this department that have been there for decades and decades. And these sometimes, you know, folks that have a different type of mentality than, you know, officers who are on the street who are like 20, 21, 22 years old, you know, who become indoctrinated and who are told by the senior members how they need to act on the street. For example, this is what happened in the situation in Minneapolis. You had cops who had just gotten out on the street, you know, they were on service for like 3 or 4 or 5 days, whatever the case was, and they were listening to this, you know, guy who was out of control.
Veteran officer. That's going to be their defense in their murder trial, that Officer Chauvin, who was actually the one with the knee on George Floyd's neck, was a veteran officer. These guys were literally, I only learned this in the last couple of days, the others or some of the others were only on the force for a matter of days. And
this is the reluctancy of a young officer to question officers who have seniority.
So let me ask you, when you say this set of reforms that needs to take place has been a long time coming, Mayor de Blasio would say that he's been instituting many reforms. This is his answer to about half my questions over the last month when I talk about how police may have been over-policing social distancing, the videos that came out around abuse on that. Then, of course, in this protest period over the last 12 days, and his answer always is, there are some bad apples, yes, but look at the systemic changes that I've made, and that's the context. And they include ending Bloomberg stop and frisk, de-escalation training, creating a minority-majority or, you know, majority-non-white force. And he lists a few other things like that that he'd say are systemic changes that he's been bringing about in his 7 years or so. Have you seen
it? Not enough. Not enough, sir. Not enough. Because you still have the pillars of what holds up the current police department. And those pillars are the mentality, the way of thinking of individuals who are in charge. When you have a company in the private sector that fails, you bring a new CEO and you bring a new form of management. That needs to be done with this department. They need to rid of most of the top personnel in this department. And
how do you see Commissioner Shea in this respect?
Well, Commissioner Shea was here in the department. He's not someone that was hired from the outside. Commissioner Shea was in the department the last 30-something years of his career. Where was his voice in the last 10 or 15 years, 5 years ago when situations like what happened in Minneapolis was happening here in New York?
Alec, I appreciate his voice. I'm going to have to move on. I appreciate your voice so much, officer. Thank you for calling in.
You're welcome, sir. Take care. Thank you for your
Thank you very much, and call us again. Troy, on what Minneapolis is doing, as of yesterday's announcement from the city council there, and whether you think something like this needs to take place here, the word they're using is disband the police department. They're going to disband the police department. They have a city council majority now in favor of this in Minneapolis, the city where, of course, George Floyd was killed. Here is Minneapolis City Council member Lisa Bender yesterday.
I just stood with a total of 9 members of the Minneapolis City Council, and we committed to dismantling policing as we know it in the city of Minneapolis and to rebuild with our community a new model of public safety that actually keeps our community safe.
And they don't know yet what that reinvention will look like, but I'm curious if you think New York needs to go that far.
I think we all need to reimagine what public safety looks like. I think, I've been on record of saying this previously, I think we ask police officers to do too much. I said this at a protest over the weekend. You know, why should a police officer with a gun show up to a scene to address someone who is in the unfortunate situation of being homeless? Why do they show up for that? Why would that not be someone showing up with resources, a social worker, or someone to show up in that aspect? Why do we need police officers with a gun to show up if a mother calls that their child unfortunately may not have taken their medication or may be suffering from a mental health break? You know, the response that's needed in that emergency situation probably is not a police officer. Right. So I invite folks to just reimagine. We have grown up in obviously a world in where we are told that police officers are the people that need to do all of these things. And what folks are inviting people to think about is, what does public safety in our community look like in general? What does keeping the community and our folks safe? And then what other resources or what other entities do we need in our communities in order to respond to that? I think the form of policing that we have now is in need of serious reform and dismantling and thinking about it different ways. So I'm not, the fear that people are using is saying, oh, we're getting rid of police and then there's going to be lawlessness. No, flip that and think about, what does public safety mean and what do we need in our communities in order to feel safe and also make sure people are properly resourced in our community? And so thinking about it in that way, rather than thinking about there's going to be lawlessness and we're getting rid of, millions of jobs of police officers, I think thinking about it in a different way of what do we need in our communities from public safety? How do we address these domestic issues, these crimes of poverty, these other issues that we've created crimes based upon people being poor? And then created an opportunity for people to have more engagement with police officers. You know, why do we need that? And so that's the movement I join. That is the movement Brooklyn NAACP and others are focused on, mm-hmm. is how do we reduce that engagement and the policing in the form that we know it now.
Let me take one more call for you before we move on to other guests. And other segments, and we'll continue, of course, to take calls throughout the morning. Our invitation to people who've been in the protest movement for this segment has been to call in and say, do you see the movement poised to accomplish concrete things, and how would you define success now that this has been going on for 2 weeks? Devin in Crown Heights is calling in with an answer to that question. Devin, you're on WNYC. Good morning.
Hi, Brian. Good morning. Thank you for everything you do. You've been so essential to us through all of this stuff. My question is, like, why can't we tie the police funding to education funding? So I work for a school system out here in Brooklyn. We've been told that next year we should expect our funding to remain flat, if not decrease. And we need the money for schools in Crown Heights. We don't need more police. Just a few months ago, before Amy Cooper, before Central Park, we had a student who was an elementary school child have the police called on him because a white woman was afraid that he was harassing her across the street from his school. And I think it highlights how we have over-policed certain neighborhoods. We are expecting the education system to take a funding cut while at the same time continuing to chronically underserve Black and brown students. And I've been out here protesting because we want the mayor to recognize that we are paying for all of this stuff. We as taxpayers are providing the money for the police and for the schools and for the healthcare system. And what we are saying when we say defund the police, it's not, to your guest's point, anarchy. It's not a lack of safety or danger. It is, if we're paying for this stuff, why can't we pay for the stuff that actually serves us, like money to retain teachers so that they don't leave the profession to make more money within 4 years, or money to open, you know, healthcare services. Like, the mayor was very upset with you the other day for you not adequately covering how his administration has spread health insurance across all of the city. But when I look out my window here in Crown Heights, every night it's cops on the corner, not people, again, funded by our taxes, signing people up for health insurance or helping people go through their options. And if we have to pay for this, why can't we pay for the stuff that actually mm-hmm. helps us and actually right. gives us what white suburban neighborhoods have had forever and therefore are not policed? Like, I think mm-hmm. there's this attitude that without the police, there is anarchy. And, you know, I'm a transplant. I'm from the suburbs. I'm from the Midwest. The police didn't police us because we as a community had what we already needed. We had schools. We had health insurance. We had the things that enabled us to community police. And that's, I think, what the defund the police movement right. is really asking for.
I hear the
thank you, Brian, so much for everything.
Making. Devin, thank you very much. So to close, Joy, again, the caller brought up, this caller too brought up this term, defund the police. Part of your background is as a political consultant. The president and Republicans generally and Fox News are already trying to make hay out of the defund or abolish the police movement and language as something that will be scary to moderate suburban voters who the president has been losing because of various policies, but hopes will come back to him and the GOP if they think the Democrats are getting too out there in a way that threatens public safety for them. So are you concerned, or what would you say to a voter who might be having such thoughts?
You know, even as a, as you say, in my day job, in my business of being a Democratic consultant, this is something that I've been saying for years to Democrats as the party and in general. We spend a lot of time trying to convince or have people that have already determined that they don't believe in you know, Democratic politics or a particular Democratic candidate. And we spent a lot of time trying to convince those folks to come over to a side when we have an enormous population of folks who do believe in our values, who do believe in things like shifting resources from criminalizing people to education and making sure that people have housing and making sure that people have food and making sure our children have full resourced schools. We already have folks already that we can win with. And if we invest, talk to, and engage those voters, we can win and not focus so much on trying to win back Trump voters or win back middle of the road voters. We have enough voters on our side that believe in our values, that if we would just talk to, engage, and have them be a part of this new society that we're trying to build that's more equitable and invest in people and resources, then we can win in that way. So I always encourage folks, rather than trying to invest and trying to persuade someone about the humanity of people of color or persuade someone in the value of investing in children and resources and healthcare and education, we have enough people on our side that we can invest in, talk to, and engage to win for that new society.
Eljoy Williams, president of the Brooklyn chapter of the NAACP. She's also a political strategist who's worked on many campaigns, including Jemani Williams, Letitia James, and Cynthia Nixon, among others, locally. And she's host of the podcast Sunday Civics. Joy, we always appreciate when you come on with us. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Brian Lehrer, a daily politics podcast, is obviously also a daily coronavirus podcast under the circumstances in our country right now. We'll keep staying on top of things to serve you the best we can. And remember, this podcast is excerpted from my live weekday call-in show, The Brian Lehrer Show. If you want to be a caller or just hear it live, it's from 10 a.m. to noon Eastern Time on WNYC Radio in New York, or online at WNYC.org. You can also tweet a question at us anytime. Just tweet at Brian Lehrer. Thanks for listening today.